Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
What's the most sustainable way to love fashion? It's changing the way you shop by shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted source for authenticated luxury resale. When you shop with The RealReal, you'll find the luxury brands you love, like Prada, Celine, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail. And when you're ready to refresh your wardrobe, you can sell the pieces you no longer wear to fund your next new-to-you finds. Buy, sell, repeat, guilt-free. The RealReal extends the life cycle of luxury by keeping coveted items in rotation. Sell to shop, shop to sell with The RealReal. It's better for the planet and better for your closet. Plus, during Earth Month, you can earn $100 extra when you sell with The RealReal. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn $100 extra during the entire month of April at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature. Although sometimes that might feel counterintuitive, just like a bird, the nightingale, singing out in the dark. I'm known as JJ the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted that you could join me for a very different show today as I reflect on some of the things I've learned on my own well-being journey here on UK Health Radio and share some of my own go-to remedies and practices that help me keep in balance on all levels, mental, spiritual, emotional, and physical. And I'm minded to do so now because, as I record this, we're approaching the 11th of November. That's the 11/11 portal and powerful point energetically in the calendar that promises to bring yet more change. As if I haven't had enough over the past year. But I know I'm not the only one, so stay tuned as later I'll be sharing two of the main techniques that I use to ride all these life changes that can be pretty tough at times. For now, sit back and relax as I pick out a couple of the major milestones from over the past year. It was around this time last year that I had a major breakthrough when I interviewed coach and fellow UK Health Radio presenter Alexia Leachman on the show about tocophobia, the fear of giving birth. Until that point, I hadn't really any idea that this was such a big thing, never mind that it had a proper name. But once I learned about it, I realised it explained a whole lot about my own life. Miscarriage, never having children, and on a non-physical level, finding it very difficult to bring my own creative ideas to fruition. All of that has shifted now. So powerful was the realization and letting go of this phobia, and I'm in a very different place in my life. If you didn't catch that interview at the time, here's a clip from it that I thought worth revisiting, even if you heard it the first time round. I found I was able to talk really openly with Alexia about my experience, but so many sources seem to describe tocophobia as a mental illness. So that's where we started our chat.
I don't think it's a mental illness. I think it's nearer an anxiety disorder. It's severe anxiety. Yeah. So it's really... You know, even though we get locked into the word fear because of the word phobia, whereas actually, if you really get clarity on what fear is, we're usually talking about anxiety unless the fear is present danger. If it's not there present in our environment, then it's an anxiety because we're kind of anticipating it. So we're really talking about birth anxieties, anxieties around pregnancy, but actually in the work that I do with helping women to conquer their tocophobia, most of the anxieties have got nothing to do with birth. So it's a complex set of anxieties that are, that when women have to confront the experience that is pregnancy and birth, they are really being forced to confront these anxieties head on. And they're actually anxieties that all humans experience, men included, but they don't have to go cross that bridge that is the pregnancy birth experience. So they can kind of sail on through life without necessarily needing to confront them in a way that a woman has to, because she's staring down the barrel of a gun, having to deal with her fear over losing control, her fear of not having control of her body, her fear of being vulnerable, her fear of change, her fear of making the wrong decision. These are things that we all suffer from, not just women on this journey. And so these are the anxieties that I help women to overcome. And it's this combination of all of them together that lines up and creates this stack called tocophobia, which is why, you know, if you want to go and use a phobia clearance technique, for example, and go, oh, I'm just going to clear my phobia of birth, you can't do that because it's not this one isolated thing. Yeah. Not like clear a phobia of spiders.
Yeah.
Or that kind of thing, or injections. Even injections is slightly more complex. Mm-hmm. But yeah, tocophobia is this, it's an amalgamation of lots of anxieties that come together, and they all need to be unpacked. And that requires an inherent knowledge of the condition and what those individual strands are, in my opinion.
Yeah. And it's not just something that's in the mind, it's held in the body as well. And, and you know, one of the reasons why we're talking today is that I heard of your experience when you say that you felt an absolute terror when you were first pregnant, and then you had a miscarriage. And for the first time in my life, and at my grand old age, you know, that's saying something, I actually heard somebody voice my experience the one time that I found out that I was pregnant, and I also, it didn't go to term. It in fact, very quickly, I had a miscarriage. But it was an abject terror.
Mm.
It wasn't just a phobia. I have never felt terror like it consciously.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, then, you know, I was asking you, what causes tocophobia? And you said often it's, you know, it goes back to childbirth or pre-birth. And interesting as well, when I was doing a little bit of research before speaking to you today, I saw that, you know, a lot of the information on the internet, it really doesn't go there in terms of birth trauma. It talks about anxieties that come in during teenage years or early 20s, that sort of thing. You know, when you are maybe thinking about having a baby, thinking about starting a family. But this was a very deep-seated, deep-rooted terror for me. And, you know, you were saying starts in childbirth, traumas in childbirth, well, of course, fitted my story totally.
Mm.
You know, born with the cord around my neck, called a blue baby, and put straight into an oxygen tent to, an incubator to make sure that I could actually get enough oxygen into my body. Now, of course, I don't have any memory of that terror, but it must have been terrifying.
And that will be within your body. That terror and that trauma is within the fabric of your very being. So the memories of that are going to be very physical. So when that's triggered, that's really going to take you to a very, very deep place.
Yeah.
And a response that is instinctive, reactive, where it bypasses the conscious mind entirely.
Exactly.
And if I was to say to you, why did you feel that way? You'd be like, well, I don't know. This is what makes it so unsettling, because people have no idea why they feel this way. And it adds to this, the distress of the condition. Because it's often rooted in a phobia, in a trauma that we have no conscious recollection on. Not always. Sometimes it's not always a birth trauma, our own birth trauma. But I would say 80% of the time it is. And because many of us don't remember our birth, it can mean that we literally just feel entirely clueless as to why we feel this way. And that just simply adds another layer to this kind of distress that you're feeling, because it makes no sense. So when people say that tocophobia is an irrational phobia, So what does irrational mean? It means it makes no sense. So the bit of it that makes no sense is, why do I feel it? Why am I suffering with this? But there's a huge part of it that makes total sense, which is birth with high maternal mortality rates is something that, is actually worth getting worried about. I mean, it's not like completely risk-free. So there are many women that suffer from tocophobia go, well, duh, of course I'm going to be scared. I could die giving birth. The doctors might decide to prioritize the baby over me. Why would I want to walk into that kind of experience? So there's a part of them that is almost screaming from the rooftops going, why doesn't anybody understand how I feel? This is so obvious. And yet there's another part of them at the same time going, but why am I feeling this? Yeah. I don't know how I'm feeling it. When my sister is pregnant, she's loving it. She's being all, you know, gorgeous and glowing and can't wait to give birth to a baby. Why am I feeling the way that I am? And so this is what makes women that suffer with it feel very isolated and alone, because they think that it's just them. And because no one's talking about tocophobia, even though it's got very high prevalence rates, so the data suggests a very low end of maybe 4 or 5%, but I think you're looking at nearer maybe 30%, because I don't think the data is necessarily gathered in a way that is reflective of what really is going on, because most women that suffer from it have never, ever put themselves in a situation where they're ever going to give birth. So how are the people gathering the data finding the prevalence rates? Are they just asking women in the maternity ward? Well, these tocophobic women are not going to be anywhere near that maternity ward, because some of them can't even get intimate with their partners or hold down a long-term relationship, because inevitably the conversation will come around to kids and suddenly they're running a mile. So, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to understand how high this prevalence rate is, which is why no one's talking about it and no one's heard of it. And yet I think a lot of women are suffering from this in silence and not even knowing that they have it in many instances.
Well, I have to thank you for opening my eyes, as I say, at this age, because I've gone through life really not understanding it at all. And, you know, two things about that. One, when I was younger and of childbearing age, I remember talking to a doctor and saying, no, you know, me and my first husband didn't want children. And that was absolutely, you know, what do you mean you don't want children? How can that be? Oh, you'll be fine. Just, you know, you'll be fine. Have a child. That'll solve all your problems. Well, really? I don't think so. And then the second thing is that I now realize, and again, I say, at this grand old age, I now realize that all my life I've been slightly uncomfortable around babies.
Mm.
And I've never talked about that with anybody before. This is a first, me confessing it now.
Yeah.
And now I realize why. And I'm getting very emotional now. But I wanted to say this now, because I suspect there are many women out there who feel the same way and don't know why, and feel that they're lesser because of it.
Mm. I had an experience when I was working, and a woman brought her twins into work. And, you know, not what normally happens is they bring babies in and everyone's cooing over the new little arrival.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then suddenly there was a milk squirting situation going on, and she had to hand one of them over, and I was standing next to her. So she handed a baby to me, and I just freaked out and had to just pass the baby on. So I was like, I literally can't hold this, take it away. And I had to go running to the toilet, and I just burst into tears. And that was in my mid-20s. And I was like, what is wrong with you? And at that, back then, I had no idea, but I was always one of these people that's like, career first, don't want kids, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that was the tocophobia speaking.
Yeah.
I was rationalizing, trying to make sense of these deep feelings that I wasn't aware of. And so just trying to come up with a way of, making it make sense to me.
Mm.
And I think, I don't know, for most people, if they don't really have an understanding, if you've seen the film Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Angelina Jolie,
yes.
There's a scene in there where she's at this do next door, and she's turned up in her thigh-high black boots, and somebody hands her a baby, and you can see her holding it like it's a pair of dirty pants.
Yeah.
And her face is like, that's a tocophobic woman right there. She's just holding it, looking at her husband over the wing in the kitchen going, oh my God, no, don't judge me for this. I honestly, I don't want this, you know. And that I think is a reflective of what women suffer it, that feel like, but let's not forget there are women that suffer with this, but desperately want kids.
Right.
So trying to make sense of this inherent desire within you to be a mother, but you know that to be a mother, you have to cross over that bridge that is the pregnancy and birth experience. And that bridge is covered in wolves bearing teeth. And you're like, how on earth am I going to make it over that? Because I can't see a way through that. That's where I was. I was like, I could imagine myself being a mother, but I couldn't draw the dots. In my head, there was a huge chasm where I couldn't figure it out. There was no path between my current state and me and motherhood, which meant that when I did fall pregnant, which was accidental, in a relationship that I'd been with somebody for 6-7 years, we hadn't had the kids conversation. So I was then wrestling with, oh my God, he's going to leave me, he doesn't want kids. I didn't even know whether he wanted kids because I'd never had that conversation with him, even though it was a serious conversation, because I couldn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't a conversation that I could have.
Yeah.
And so I think this is very typical of that experience where, and when I've described this thing where people can't see a path between where they are now and motherhood, because it just, they've blacked it out. They have just literally, whatever happened to them that made them fear it, that the trauma has just created this huge pit of blackness that means they it's not lit up. They can't see what's going on there and there's no way through it. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does make sense. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And of course, you feel, well, I don't know if I felt anything really. I didn't understand the terror when that happened. And I've never really quite understood the kind of discomfort that I felt around babies and, you know, you say, absolutely, everybody's cooing around a newborn baby and you're just standing there thinking, well, I don't know, really, I don't know about this. And you can, if you allow it to, feel very uncomfortable and very other, you know, not quite part of the human race because you're not cooing over this new life and being delighted. But, you know, it's that lack of understanding. But then if you talk to anybody about that, you are condemned as a heartless woman because women are supposed to have children, love children, be mothers. And if you're not that, there can be an awful lot of othering going on.
Yeah. And let's not forget that there are some women that just don't want kids.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that you have tocophobia. So I've got a lot of women that come to me for help and they want help making that decision. At the moment, they might be in a place where I want to make a decision, but I don't know whether it's my tocophobia speaking or if it's my heart. And I need to clear the fear so that I can tune into my heart and hear what that wants.
Yeah, nice.
And
yeah.
So there's a lot of women I've worked with where, you know, we've cleared all the trauma and the fear. And now they're like, actually, I don't want kids. And I'm okay with that. I'm peaceful with that decision. And that's the right thing for me right now. Of course, I might change my mind in a few years. But right now, this is not what I want.
Yes.
And to be able to answer that truly and not make that call from a place of fear, the way you know, when you're forced to make a decision from a place of fear, you know that it's, you're on shaky territory. And so it might be that later on, maybe you revisit that decision and then it's filled with regret because you know you didn't make it from the right place. And so I've also worked with women that are way past being able to have a baby. So they're in their mid-40s, for example, and they want to make peace with that decision because it continues to eat them up inside because they know that they were making it from a place of fear. And they just want to know, what would my decision be? And I need to reach a place of peace with this because these decisions, they stay with us until the last breath, just as our birth experience does.
Yeah.
So these are very profound experiences for women. And, you know, whether your decision, whether or not to have a child, if you do decide to go ahead, what that birth experience is like, what that pregnancy experience is like, these are experiences that will live with you forever. So it's important that you reach a place of peace and contentment around those decisions and around those experiences. Because every time you have a birthday, your kid has a birthday, you will be reminded of that birth. Just as I've just had my two have just had their births. And the second birth I had was just the most incredible, profound experience. And now I can feel myself just getting emotional thinking about it again, because it was so incredible. And whenever it's her birthday, I just get filled with the memories of that incredible experience. Now, if that's a traumatic experience, I can't bear to think what I would have to go through every year until I die, having to relive that.
Yeah.
So, you know, doing this emotional work to prepare for these kind of life stages, these life events that we go through as women, I think is incredibly important, because we owe it to ourselves, because we have to live with ourselves forever.
Yeah. Alexia Leachman there. Alexia is the founder of Head Trash, and she's the developer of Head Trash Clearance, which is a potent clearance technique for getting rid of fears, anxieties, traumas, self-doubts and sabotage. So you can see how she was absolutely ideal, the right person for me there. She's the author of Clear Your Head Trash, How to Create Clarity, Confidence and Peace in Your Life. And her book, Fearless Birthing, shares how this technique can be used to overcome pregnancy and birth fears. Now, you will have heard us talking about holding mental or emotional issues in our physical body. This is something that I've come to understand at a very deep level recently, and is my next well-being win. Before I get into that, though, it's time for a short break. Stay with me for more right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
I sold my car in Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, the Practical Alchemist. And it's just me today, reflecting on some health and life wins this past year. As we heard very clearly before the break, sometimes the cause of a well-being issue is far from obvious. Sometimes it's buried deep within our psyche, and sometimes the root of it lies in our ancestral line. So as well as birth trauma, I've been consciously clearing ancestral trauma, especially since I returned to the country and region I was born in. Scotland has a turbulent history, a history of struggle, battle, exploitation and persecution, seen writ large in the latter case through the witch trials that were held throughout this country and Europe. The wounds from this persecution have been something never far from my conscious thought, as I now live in a village famous for being the scene of one of the last witch trials in Scotland. I pass the place where people were locked up, starved and tortured every day. But every time my thoughts reach out to those people, I make a point of noticing the effect on my body and allowing it to pass through and leave my system. I feel I can do so much more effectively as I've rooted myself once again into my homeland, the place of my birth, and this year recognised for the first time in my life that this really is home. As the ancestral healing practitioner Callie White says on her website, loveisourpower.com, we root, we rewire, we rise. And I've felt that this year. Here's Callie talking to me a while back about the importance and effect of Europe's witch trial era on our consciousness.
Yes, so the witch burnings, even though they happened, you know, almost 300 years ago, it was a phenomenon that swept Europe for about 300 years. that created a mass hysteria, that created a mass psychosis, if you like, and was really a genocide against the power of women. And by power, I don't mean in the patriarchal sense of power over. I mean the natural ways of being woman are, intuition, connection to nature, connection to each other. And it's a very complex period of history. It started in the late 1400s, a Dominican inquisitor sent by Rome working in Austria, deeply misogynistic. He instigated his own witch trials in this part of Austria. And what that led to was the writing of the Malleus Maleficarum, which was it's also known as the Hammer of Witches. And it became a guidebook that spread across Europe. This was the time of the invention of the printing press. And the Malleus Maleficarum was one of the first publications that went national and then across Europe. And in it, he describes, what a witch is. It's a woman that has denounced God. She's working with the devil. The devil is working through her. She is having sex with the devil. And women were more likely to become witches because they were the weaker sex, that was the view. And more likely to be swayed by the charm of the devil. So it described what a witch was, the definition of a witch, and it also described what witchcraft was. And witchcraft was using magic to cause harm, be that to other people, be it to animals, be it to, failed crops, causing storms, all sorts of things. And those definitions became rooted in the psyche of our European ancestors and are very much at the heart of then what happened and the witch hunts that swept across Europe and then initially into Scotland through King James VI, who was betrothed to Anne of Denmark. He'd been to Denmark, he'd witnessed the witch trials happening there, and then they came over the waters to Scotland, and the North Berwick trials being one of the first big national Scottish trials.
And let's be clear, most of these women and some men were by no means casting spells, riding around on broomsticks and keeping black cats for company. These were usually just ordinary people, weren't they?
Yeah. So what the trial records show is, they were just normal women and normal men. Often they were the local healers. At the time of, they were called cunning folk, cunning women, cunning men. And at that time, the word cunning actually meant somebody that had a knowing. So somebody that used their intuition or magic, if you like, working with plants, working with herbs to create medicines and lotions and potions. So many of the trial records show that those accused were healers. Many of them were old people, were the elders of the communities, women that, this was a period of history where a lot of the men had gone to war or they had to go off to find work elsewhere. And so there was a high percentage of widows in the communities at a time when if you didn't have a man, it was difficult to survive if you didn't have family. So these older women were, a burden on the village and depended on alms. And the other group of women that were targeted were midwives. It's a really fascinating and quite a complex period of history. There's no one pattern. What happened in Scotland was very different to what happened in England, for example. But what happened over time was, even though the witch hunts were initiated by the church and supported by the state in many countries, and acts of parliament were passed and witchcraft was made illegal, what happened over time was the witch hunt became the way that anybody could get rid of somebody that was in the way.
Yeah.
So what we see is neighbors turning against neighbors. And why this is interesting to me is, the history in itself is interesting, but it's the epigenetic piece that has been interesting to me, is that it's the inherited trauma from those times and understanding, for me, this came through my own work and my own personal journey, understanding that some of my beliefs, some of my behavior patterns, the way I responded to certain situations, you know, I had a realization that it hadn't initiated with me. It wasn't my stuff. You know, then I set off to research this further and spoke to a lot of women in my circles, and there's so much resonance and other women feeling this too. And I guess the conclusion, if you like, is that as this trauma, you know, traumatized parents will raise traumatized children. And actually, this is a collective issue. We're swimming in a dirty water, if you like. Mm. And the water's so dirty, we're in it, it's difficult to see that we're in it. But we're not designed to be this way. We're not designed to live our lives in a traumatized state a lot of the time. And the conclusions I came to through the work I did with women and, you know, and through my own personal work was that the witch hunts, they created a wound in the psyche of humanity, like that deep, that we still haven't recovered from. And that wound is a wound of separation. And a wound of separation that it separated us from ourselves, from our own intuition and our own authority. It separated us from each other. You know, when you think of the women were forced under torture to betray each other and give names. So that created a wave of mistrust between women. And then the third wound of separation is from nature, because suddenly having knowledge of plant medicine and herb law became, it was a dangerous thing to know about. And so it stopped getting passed on. Scientifically, it's not proven, because the length of our lives are so long, but scientists have proven it with other species. So with mice, for example, they've discovered a trauma response can be passed on down through 20 generations of mice. And our DNA is only 5% different to that of a mouse. So it's not a huge leap of faith to think that trauma is passed down through our DNA and our generations too.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we feel it, like we know it in the therapeutic world and in the women's circles and the women's empowerment world that I've, you know, worked within for the last 15, 20 years. It's like, we know this stuff. We feel it in our bones. It's a somatic response.
And if you're wondering how that works physically, I think Darlene de la Plata, a health and wellness expert known as the Herb Mom and another great past guest, explains it very well. Here's Darlene.
Part of healing the ancestral trauma and part of what we're all dealing with right now globally is the energy of fear. And throughout different eras of time, we're going to call it the people who make the rules benefit when people stay in fear. Yeah. And fear lowers your vibration, it shrinks your energy field, it lowers your immunity, which kind of puts you at the mercy of whatever the thing is at that moment. And so what I talk about a lot is that our bodies look dense. They look physical. But the truth is we're really less than 1% physical matter. And we are over 99% energetic matter. And because of that, dealing with any problem, we don't even like to call it a problem, let's call it an opportunity. Dealing with anything in the physical body, we tend to get a physical diagnosis about physical symptoms on our physical body or the physical world. And then we look for physical solutions, right? But the 99% of us that is invisible has 99% invisible solutions at our disposal, which are infinitely easier to call in. They don't take any money. They don't take any resources. They just take the ability for us to step outside of the brainwashing of what we've been told is normal and venture into what I like to call just the land of what if, right? Because if we can wrap our brains around the idea that we have infinitely more abilities or were infinitely able to do really anything to these bodies, because we really only have enough physical matter to fit on the tip of our pinky. I mean, how is that even possible, right? I mean, how is that even a thing? And it's all swirling around. You know, if you ask a scientist what we're made of, I draw a picture quite often. It's a little stick man. And I say that 90% of that stick man is bacteria. So 9 out of every 10 cells in our body is a bug, right? So we don't look like bugs. We look like people.
Yeah.
But if we take out all the bugs and we take out what the scientists would say were made of water and empty space and tissue cells, well, I say that's partially right. We are made of water, but we're made of intelligent water. You know, I grew up hearing the water, we were solid, liquid, and a gas, end of story. And now we know there's a fourth phase of water, which is the intelligent water. Mm-hmm. And there's remarkable studies on that. But anyway, each molecule of that intelligent water has about 40,000 computer screens carrying words and vibrations and information and emotions. And it's kind of a data storage tank, right? So eliminate the water, eliminate the bugs. The scientists are calling it empty space. I'm calling that the God space of limitless potential, the zero point field. And then they're saying we're made of tissue salts. And I'm going to say really we're made of stardust. We're made of the same stuff that the galaxies are made out of. So if you take out all the water, the zero point field, the bacteria, what's left is that little tiny bit of stardust with infinite potential. And it's swirling around the thing that makes you look like you and me look like me and the cat look like the cat is it's all swirling around to this symphony of amazing frequencies that most of us can't hear. And it never stops. It never sleeps. And so I kind of really launch from that place to have. So really, we're multidimensional beings having a physical experience, right?
Mm.
And we should think of our bodies as a canvas. You know, I know there's a painting in my background. I can't scrape the paint off the painting and put it on a canvas. It has to start on a palette first, right?
Yeah.
So our bodies are a canvas, and the palette that it draws from to paint the picture of who we are is made of thoughts. It's made of emotions, memories, ancestral imprints, sound, light, resonance, food, and our somatids. And somatids, kind of the rediscovery for me of somatids took me down a rabbit hole that I was really not prepared for. And talking about stuff like this, you know, we had talked about the burning times, you know, talking about stuff like this would have definitely had me, you know, launched into that. Whole part of history.
Yeah.
And so being born right now, I think really saved me from all of that. But things that we accept as science today, really were not allowed in a very short time ago in our history. There's the psychoneuroimmunology, which really says that the body-mind connection has an effect on our being. There's epigenetics that says your genes are not your destiny. You know, it's like poker. You're dealt a hand. You don't like it. You can throw some of the cards in and swap them out for other cards. We have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the somatids are the smallest piece of intelligent life in our body that are the architects of our DNA. And they respond to that intelligent water. They respond to our words. They respond to our emotions. They respond to everything. And they can't be killed by fire. So even when they were burning the witches, and they didn't kill the somatids. They just were all the ones that are on this planet have always been here, and they always will be here. They can't be killed by fire or freezing. So they collect these things from our palate, and they actually help create our canvas that is us. And you know, have you ever bought a painting and then embellished it a little, like brought it home and added color or did something to it to make it a little more unique? We have the ability to do that to our canvas. If we don't like the canvas we have, we can embellish it, we can change it, we can we can improve it any way that we want.
Darlene de la Plata there. See, that's the good news. And you might say that I've been remixing my colour palette this last year. I've been letting go big time and finding that voice that was suppressed along my ancestral line. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. First, time for another short break. I'll be back with you right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and I've been reflecting on some of the well-being wins I've experienced this past year. I've been unblocking my creativity and finding my voice, something I talked a lot about with my Hurt Less, Live More show co-host, Dr. Mark Goulston, the Los Angeles-based psychiatrist, coach and mentor and author of many books. I was so deeply affected when Mark died after receiving a bone marrow transplant at the end of December last year. His last email to me had mentioned how much he was looking forward to helping me bring my authentic voice out into the world much more than it was then. But here's the thing, I was devastated to lose, as I thought, such a good friend and mentor. But you know, he isn't lost. He's just with me in a different way. I often hear him cheering me on and really do still feel his support. Mark approached the possibility of his possible death with such equanimity, letting go of any fear and looking forward to the next phase of his journey. In the last show we recorded together, before he went into hospital for his procedure just before Christmas last year, he revealed his diagnosis to our guest, Dr. Ski Chilton, a scientist and polymath who is really helping people through his books, the latest being There Is Another Way to Happiness, the four-step CAST process that will transform your life. And that's CAST, spelt C-A-S-T. Now here's Ski reacting to Mark's news that he has a cancer and was going to be going in to hospital for a bone marrow transplant. And how, remarkably, he was feeling really good about it.
Bless you, Mark. Bless you. I completely resonate with what you're saying. And you know, I like I said, the last chapter of this book is coming to peace with the unknowables. And it is about death and dying. And you know, for in this particular chapter, Embracing the Unknowables, really for me, it was about, first of all, unlearning so much that I had learned before in my religious, my background. But then it once again, it was this whole becoming a child again, this whole wonder, this whole, and I love that, you know, what you said a second ago, that you're looking forward to the journey. You're looking forward to going into that. That's what a child would do. You're looking, that's beautiful. I mean, it's exactly, you know, this is a new journey in your life. You know, I love the whole idea of, you know, our lives as rivers, and we're floating down them, and you know, we stay in the river, we don't get out to the side, we don't put rocks in our pockets to come down, and you know, we don't put our feet down and break our legs. We just float in the river to the sea, but there's a class 5 rapid in front of you. And it's going around a turn, and you don't know what's around the other turn. But I sense from you that you're going to keep your feet up and you're going to go through that class five rapid. And if a log comes along and you want to float with the log, it's going to float with you. And what's around the corner is around the corner, but there's a wonder even what's around the corner. So you're headed to the sea. You believe that you're where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be, and you're loving the world the whole time through conversations like these. So bless you. Bless you.
I just got an insight into you. Can I share it with you and tell me if it resonates? I was a suicide prevention specialist, and none of my patients died by suicide in 35 years. And it was by going into their world, letting go of me completely, and just diving into the dark night of the soul until I found them. And then I just held them by the nape of the neck until they started to cry. I have a sense that there really was a lot of shame, the dyslexia, Appalachia. And what happened is you learned to cope. But the coping was not the same thing as healing from the trauma. But boy, you rode that for a while. And like you said, your public persona, you were knocking down all kinds of things, but something was missing. And what was missing is your ability to deeply connect with people you love and maybe connect with yourself. And it feels like you, and again, if you're listening, let's not throw away coping. Coping's great. Coping's better than not coping, but it's not the same thing as healing.
No.
And what I do is you've stepped into healing, and it's a whole different journey that's shown you vistas and experiences that you never had before.
The wonderful Dr. Ski Chilton and the late wonderful Dr. Mark Goulston. And Mark was so right. Coping and healing are not the same by any means. I believe that one comes from stress and the other out of love. By now you might have guessed a couple of themes. How to let go of even the deepest wounds and patterns. And also the power of love to heal. Even though it's been a tough year for me, I feel I can now easily let go of fears, anxieties and traumas that underlie so many health issues. And here's how to do it. Simply sit quietly for just a few minutes each day and notice what comes up without judgment. Feel whatever you're feeling. Name it if you can or want to. And then allow that to leave you. Imagine it forming a cloud, maybe, and passing through your skin barrier out into the air to be carried off by a breeze. Or you can notice where you're feeling stuck in your body. Give your body a scan. You might notice feelings showing up as little dark parcels of soot. One way to deal with that is to imagine a cosmic vacuum cleaner coming in to suck up all that soot right out of your body. You can have the cleaner emptied way out in space if you like, just to make sure it's all gone and won't be coming back. And of course, the other theme is love. Loving and accepting what is. Loving others and ourselves. Being able to look in the mirror and say, "I love you," to yourself. Practicing self-care and live our lives according to nature's principles. There really has been a lot of change this year, and I can't wait to see what change the 1111 portal brings. Meanwhile, I hope that you've enjoyed this show. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining me another time. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.